Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm excited about having Jim Ostroff back on the show. He's a good friend, a longtime member of our Brain Trust. He's associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and he's our good friend. Jim Ostroff, welcome back to the show.
And good morning, Jim. Good morning, everyone.
It's good to have you here. Before we get into the letter and the news that you guys have published, let's do a little current events, a little weather reporting there. You're in our nation's capital, and your part of the world has been inundated, as has the whole eastern seaboard in Pennsylvania, the tri-state area, et cetera, have just been deluged. I think, as you said off the air a few minutes ago, a biblical proportion.
Oh, yes.
What's the news there in the D.C. area?
Yeah, well, I mean, beginning on Saturday, it began to rain and rain and rain some more. But it wasn't any sort of light precipitation. These were torrential rains that in some areas, more than 10 inches in a day in some places.
Well, there was one place I heard a few days ago, south of you in Maryland, I've forgotten, Federalville, Maryland, or somewhere like that, that there was like 12 inches in one night, maybe even.
And that was
when you guys got 5 inches that night in the D.C. area.
Yeah, it did vary, but also these were torrential rains. I've been through a few hurricanes, and I can report objectively the waterfall was no heavier than during a full-fledged, full-flown hurricane.
Yeah.
Even a large portion of even downtown Washington had to be closed.
Well, and several agencies were out of business.
Oh, yes. We had the Internal Revenue Service.
I think the Justice Department may have been out of business, too.
Justice Department was closed. Yeah. Internal Revenue Service closed.
Boy, I hate it when the IRS is down. That's a bummer. That's a real bummer.
I know. I know.
But anyway, good luck to you guys.
It's
bizarre. But, of course, Jim, a lot of people are attributing this to global warming, to fossil fuels and all that sort of thing. And it's just kind of funny to see people get hysterical over the weather. And, we'll discuss it in a future interview, folks, whether any of this has anything to do with global warming. Jim and I are not going to wander over into that too much. But it is important, Jim, for us to point out that we have there are issues on the table these days with regard to energy, because, as we know, fossil fuels are higher. They're much higher. They're coming down a little bit, but they're still pretty high. And it's causing people to look at other alternatives, isn't it, Jim?
Well, it is. And we're talking here about things like ethanol and solar power and wind power and others. The point here is, in a few words, is that this is not happening because of government fiat or directive,
right.
But this is the marketplace and our system working. And we're seeing ultimately billions of dollars invested by individuals via venture capital funds and companies to develop these other energy sources because it makes economic sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of a fiat by government.
Well, and that's how most good things happen. That's what the market does. The market is like water; it seeks its own level, when things get more expensive, then the marketplace will find a cheaper way to do things, a more efficient way to do things. When a commodity is cheap, the marketplace is going to use that commodity.
That's right. Absolutely.
And so that's what's happened. And of course, one thing some people have suggested over the years is that the government ought to tax petroleum more to drive people to come up with other ideas. Well, that's a backward way to think about things. That's a that's a socialistic way to think about things, if you ask me. I mean, we ought to be able to use the commodities that we have readily available, but at the same time, what's happening, of course, part of what's happening, one of the reasons the price is high, is part of it is instability in the region where most of the oil comes from, but a lot of it, a huge amount of the price increase is because of supply and demand.
Oh, it is. It is. And I must say over here, yet once again, the federal investigation, actually two of them by Congress and Federal Trade Commission, found there was no price gerrymandering at the pump last year. It's like every year there's another investigation and they find the same thing. No funny money.
Well, I I'm a capitalist, and I believe that the oil companies, if they're using those profits, let me put it this way. I just think that if I were them, I'd find a way to make record prices and record profits. They always seem to coincide. Record prices to us, record profits by the oil companies always seem to coincide. And if I were them, I'd do a little better PR job. I'd be showing people, making more of an effort to show people how I'm investing all those profits into future energy sources, which would not just be petroleum.
Oh, absolutely, virtually all of the major oil companies are looking at other things, and they're plowing money into other things.
Well, what I'm getting at, though, is I think they probably are, but they need to be saying, okay, here's how much we're spending on this or that, on hydrogen or solar or wind or whatever it may be. But I do know that record profits and record prices are not good, do not make for good PR.
They don't, and there's been some of this by oil companies and their trade group, but not very much. For instance, one company who's been leading the pack in this is General Electric.
Right.
Ek imagination. Mm-hmm. But they're not an oil company.
Right. Yes. What about solar? Is that something you guys reported on this week?
We see, you might say, production of power by all type of solar energy as growing very rapidly because investment is continuing to grow in that. And it has to do with new technologies and the more efficiency of solar.
Of the cells.
Of the cell itself. More efficient, less cost.
Hold on to that thought, Jim. Jim Ostroff and I are going to come right back. We've got a lot more to come after these messages. It's 20 after. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with us. We're back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, a small business advocate, and having a great visit with our good friend Jim Ostroff. He's associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and we're talking about what Kiplinger has to say about what's going on in the world these days. Right now, we're talking about energy and some of the alternatives that are out there that are happening, and what Kiplinger has been reporting on this week: alternatives to electricity, alternatives to fossil fuels, which most electricity comes from, but a lot of it does. There's a lot of hydropower out there as well, but a lot of our electricity and electricity around the world comes from the burning of coal and natural gas. Jim, we were talking about solar a minute ago. One of these days, I don't know if you and I will live to see it, but one of these days, you'll have a power pack on your house, and it'll be maybe the size of a walk-in closet or something maybe, mm-hmm. and incorporated into that power pack will be something that channels the wind. If the wind blows, it creates a minuscule mega part of a level of power. There'll be a solar panel on it. There'll be, you know, some there'll be some electricity. You can connect less electricity to it. But what I'm getting at is that there'll be one thing all combined together that your house or your business will pull power from a reservoir that has been created by a multitude of these things. If it's windy, then you won't use as much electricity. If the sun's shining bright and the wind's blowing, then you'll get a double impact, and you'll store some of this energy. And I believe that's going to be down the road. What do you think?
Good idea. In fact, the market wizards have anticipated this, and in fact, there are some companies now out there beginning to do just that and offer, you might say, alternate energy kits. And literally, there are some in a large backpack, essentially. It's a little bigger than that, but where you can erect a small little windmill to generate electricity, and it has solar cells on the outside to do that as well.
But now, I'm just saying that. But one day, I didn't want to make it sound like I had thought of that. I just meant that one day that'll be a standard on every house.
And it won't.
Right now, that what you just described is a novelty.
Oh yeah, it is.
But in time to come, it'll be a standard as a water heater in a house.
Most likely in most places, and that will supplement, your electricity and reduce the need for electricity,
right?
Or for heating, you might say. All of these things are coming along right now. It's gaining a little bit more momentum, but again, it's because that's what we all are demanding. Mm-hmm. And once again, you have people in business who look for opportunities, niches, and they're moving in that direction now. So it is happening. It's still a bit down the road before we see huge scale implementation of things like, portable power packs, but
right.
It's happening.
What about ethanol?
Well, I mean, ethanol is growing by leaps and bounds. And it's in part it is due to what amounts to the elimination of a certain gasoline additive, the so-called MTBE. Effectively, it can't be used anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, the very gasoline refiners need to use something else to achieve various so-called clean air blends. Ethanol is the only practical thing they can use right now. So. Demand is soaring, production is ramping up as fast as possible, and it's interesting where last year in the energy law, Congress mandated that by 2012, the U.S. refiners use 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol, again by 2012,
mm-hmm.
and that's probably going to happen now by the end of perhaps next year. So
I've been doing a little bit of reading on the ethanol. Option as an alternative, and what I found, Jim, if I remember correctly, is that most automobiles can be made to run on ethanol, and if companies, the manufacturers, wanted to change over, I don't think it would take an awful lot to put ethanol completely 100% ethanol burning vehicle fuel in vehicles. I'm not sure about the performance. I'm not clear about that. But here's the main thing about that, Jim, that seems to me today the problem with ethanol is that it takes energy to create ethanol. It takes corn. You're growing corn. You're growing switchgrass or whatever the different kinds of fuels that are being used, of commodities are being used to make it. But in the process of growing it, harvesting it, and making it so that it will burn in an automobile, you're using about as much petroleum and other energy as you're creating. So it's not. It may not even be a 1-to-1 ratio.
No, at this point. It's not an energy saver, not at all. And
it makes people feel better. And of course, one thing about it, if we could cut down on our emissions, that would be a good investment.
Yeah, it would. But the other thing is, they cannot make enough ethanol.
That's the problem.
Cannot make enough ethanol.
Cannot make enough to supply everything. And that's where we're stuck, ladies and gentlemen. If you've been wondering about that, I know you have. 29 after, we'll be right back with our good friend Jim Ostroff. He's with the Kiplinger Editors. Stay with us.
For the fulcrum in the void, following your destiny, our steps cannot avoid.
Yep, he's done it again, folks.
Oh, no, not again. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Named to Talkers Magazine's Heavy 100 for the third year in a row.
It's not the first time. It won't be the last.
He's Jim Blassingame, the small business advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. My website is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Thank you for checking it out when you get a chance. And thank you for those of you who've been subscribing to my newsletter. We appreciate that very much. Those of you who've been checking out our blog, thank you for that, too. And we're having a record month on the website. Those of you who've been using it to your advantage, it makes me very happy to know that the hard work that we do here to provide you with the maximum opportunity to be successful, the content, all the things that we do, the articles, the archives, the blog, everything that we, the books, everything that me and my Brain Trust members make available to you on our websites. We really appreciate you taking advantage of that. It tells me that the small business owners want to learn how to get better and how to be more successful. It's very exciting to me to think about that. Jim Ostroff is our guest. I get excited every time he's on the show. He's our good friend from Kiplinger, associate editor there with the Kiplinger Editors. And Jim, any last thoughts on the alternative energy before we go?
Well, only that the manufacture and use of all sorts of alternative energies will continue to grow, and there will be some very big investment opportunities in companies doing the work and selling the products.
Part of the problem we got, though, Jim, is politics. So much of what's wrong with the world today has been created by politicians.
Well, it's always politics.
And lack of leadership.
Yeah, well, and whether it be politicians, honestly, interfering in the marketplace, causing distortions.
Not understanding, making decisions based on politics not on good policy.
Oh, absolutely. And the next election that's coming up just around the bend.
Right. Yeah, it's called a conflict of interest, folks. They're getting reelected conflicts with what's the right thing to do and what's right for us. And so we're all going to have to take a little harder look at all of this. Jim, let's move over and talk about the economy. Before we get into some of the other things that you guys talk about, I want you to help me incorporate my FedWatch show into our discussion. I predicted in December of last year, for my 2006 predictions, that the Fed would raise rates all the way up to 5 points on the Fed funds rate, which would make prime rate 8%. And that's where they are right now. So until for at least a few more hours, my prediction stood very well. But apparently, according to my economist experts and perhaps even Kiplinger, I don't know what Kiplinger has to say about this, I think my prediction is going to fall today. What do you think?
Well, I would say you have been absolutely right and on the money up until this morning. And it's likely the Fed is going to do yet another quarter point or 25 basis point increase in the Fed funds rate. But the thing here is most analysts expected that they were going to be more or less cutting off at the 5% level and saying, that much and no more. Mm-hmm. But the economy has shown some unexpected and strong resilience. Earlier in the year and even through now. And so the Fed is concerned that, there might be overheating that could lead to inflation. So that's why they're...
Well, what they need to realize is that small businesses are getting a double whammy right now. They're getting hit with higher interest rates. They're getting hit with higher energy costs, most of which is very difficult to pass along to our customers in the form of higher prices. And small businesses don't have, you know, if GM or General Electric or one of the other big companies, if they have a bad year, Jim, they go into the public markets and they raise the capital they need and they live to fight another day.
Right.
Small business owners are, none of us are more than, you know, we could be only a few days or weeks or months. Sometimes if you've been around a while, you can weather a year or two, but a lot of small businesses are not that far away from failure. And if the capital that they have, the precious capital they have, gets sucked out of the business, well, in the form of a tax, which in my opinion, higher interest rates and higher petroleum prices are basically a tax on us. When that gets sucked out of our business, we become more vulnerable. And with the small businesses in America creating over half the U.S. economy, I've only got this one thing to say to Mr. Banker, Mr. Bernanke. Beware, sir, that you don't kill the goose that's laying the golden egg.
That is the big concern and the big worry that they have overreacted.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I hope, and I know he listens to the show, Jim, so I'm sure he'll take that into his meeting. Stand by, we're going to take a quick break. It's 20 till. I'm Jim Blasingame. We've got a lot more stuff to come with our good friend Jim Ostroff. He's with the Kiplinger Editors.
See the dog and butterfly.
Faster we run, the further away the dreams that we chase become. Lost in the sun, spinning and turning, blind in the burning light.
Welcome back. It's 17 till. That's Dan Fogelberg. Great singer, great songwriter, great artist. Understand he's been having some health problems of late, and we wish him well. That's from the Innocent Age album, by the way, folks. I've worn out, I don't know how many cassettes of that album. And I've got the CD, and I've got I've even got the vinyl, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great album. It's a two-album set, and if it's still available, I think it is. It'd be a great present for yourself, to give yourself. Dan Fogelberg. Jim Ostroff is our guest, and he's a great guy himself, and he's with the Kiplinger Editors. And I always like telling my audience about Kiplinger's website, because it's a very helpful, very useful website. A lot of free stuff there. But if you subscribe to any of their publications, you get access to the back of the website where all the really good stuff is. And folks, their publication, the Kiplinger Letter, which has been around now continually every week since 1923, is the one that Jim and I and Joan and I work off of every week. That's a weekly publication. And then they have three biweekly letters, their California Letter, the Tax Letter, and the Agriculture Letter. Going out to our wonderful heroes, those farmers across America. And then you've got a magazine, Jim.
Well, yes, the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, which, in a way, like the letter, but the Personal Finance was the inventor, you might say, of that genre of journalism.
Absolutely.
These are
the original ones, folks, and they're still great. And I encourage you can subscribe at their website. But also, Jim, you got a phone number too, don't you?
Yes, we do. There's a toll-free phone number, and that is 800-544-0155.
Well, check that out when you get a chance. Jim, let's move down and talk about equipment leasing. You guys point out that equipment leasing companies may be suffering in the future as customers weigh the alternatives to buying. Tell us about that.
Well, yes. You know, there is the FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards
FASB.
Board,
mm-hmm.
FASB, and they are independent. They're not a government agency, but they set the accounting standards. They're going to be making some changes in the rules this summer, and as a result, you know, something about $1.25 trillion in lease-related liabilities that are held by American companies, mm-hmm. now will have to be included on their balance sheets before 2010. That means that it will increase their debt. And
is this where the IRS is going to redefine many lease relationships as capital leases rather than in pure leases?
Well, yeah.
Is that what that means? A capital lease, meaning it's just, you're calling it a lease, but it's tantamount to a purchase, and therefore it becomes an asset and an obligation.
That is correct. And so in short, that is likely to increase, you know, leaseholders' borrowing costs, which, of course, cut into their earnings. And, you know, particularly all those equipment leasing companies in our country are likely to take a hit, you know, as because companies will weigh the, you know, their relative costs of leasing versus buying, mm-hmm. whether it be a vehicle or warehouse or other property.
Jim, another thing that we reported on earlier in the month that I want to cover again with you for a couple of minutes is this Supreme Court ruling on wetlands. This is continuing to talk about property, folks. In the property discussion, the Supreme Court ruled made a ruling on what is a wetlands. This recently, didn't they?
Well, they did, and. Now, of course, and the thing is, of course, it still will be a few years before the required, you might say, regulatory definitions of wetlands are sorted out to the point that, you know, that landowners will have any more leeway than they do now on development. But the thing is, landowners, and, you know, there are thousands and thousands of companies and individuals that own land, really going to have some real legal headaches down the roads.
But didn't the Supreme Court rule that in this case that they had recently, it was nothing more than a drainage ditch that this guy was trying to develop, and the greenies took him to court, right. And which went all the way to the Supreme Court to try to claim that it was a wetlands, if I'm not mistaken. And didn't he prevail?
And he did. Over here.
So good for the Supreme Court on that one, folks, if I understand that what happened there correctly. But the thing is that, you know, we're not talking about, Jim, we're not talking about...
the Everglades.
You know, yeah, we're not talking about where the deer and the antelope roam here, folks. We're talking about our ducks and waterfowl and you know, sweet little turtles and things like that. We're talking about a drainage ditch.
Right.
That occasionally has water in it.
That's right. That's right.
And that literally, that's the case, folks. And the greenies took him to court and said, no, you can't develop over that. That's a wetlands.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if we're going to be able to use our property, we got to be able to protect ourselves against those things. And I want to thank the guy who took this all the way to the Supreme Court to make an issue out of this. This is an important a milestone, an important landmark decision. Jim, let's move over and talk, before we go to the break, bacon. You guys are smelling bacon there in Washington, D.C., aren't you?
Well, yes, we are. And because Congress is at work, you know, on various spending bills for the coming fiscal year that begins in October. You know, what with elections, you know, just a few months off here, many of our members of Congress are beating the bushes here to make money available for special projects.
And Mr. Bush has yet to produce his first veto, but he is trying to get the line item veto. When we come back, I'm going to ask Jim if he thinks he's likely to get it. It's 10 till. Here's Hart to take us out. Back at 7 till, I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're having a great visit with our good friend Jim Ostroff, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Jim, the line item veto is Mr. Bush is yet to have his first veto, and which is a record, I think, by now, certainly.
Yeah.
Very disappointing that he hasn't. That's one of the things I'm disappointed in him. But I just wonder if he'd had the line item veto all along, if he wouldn't have been able to further hold down some spending. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's certainly possible. Of course, Congress can override that, but it would take a so-called supermajority.
Right.
Hard to get. I would think likely that President Bush with a line item veto probably would have gone and zeroed out various lines here.
Line item veto makes sense for everybody but Congress, right?
Well,
all the stakeholders in America would benefit from line item veto, except 535 people.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is that our representative senators on both sides of the aisle are not going to go and vote in any way to give the president this, because it would adversely affect their ability to insert pet projects and pork spending.
Right.
It just is. And, you know, their point is, well, you know, we are much more in touch with the American people and our constituents, and, you know, we know how best to spend the money.
Yeah, we've seen how in touch they have been lately, haven't we? It is cold cash come to mind. But let's move on down, Jim, and talk a little bit about the unions are popped up on your radar screen, and well, you guys say they're wanting to expand their ranks, but Kiplinger says they're having a little trouble. What's going on?
Well, that's right, because the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, is going to broaden the definition of a supervisor, and that will let firms, you know, keep more workers essentially from joining unions. It should be out, we think, by the fall, and initially it's going to apply, you know, basically to nurses.
Because supervisors aren't necessarily they're part of management.
That is part
of management, not as part of labor.
That is correct.
Right.
And of course, you can expect like the AFL-CIO to try to appeal this and perhaps take it up to the Supreme Court, but it doesn't stand much of a chance.
Right. Jim, let's move over and talk about a little global business. One of the most interesting things going on right now is the difficulties that Airbus, the European Union partially state-owned airline manufacturer, the only real competitor to Boeing these days, is Airbus, and it's what is it? Germany, England, and France. Are those the three?
Right. Yes. That's
those are the three countries who've gone together to basically help underwrite this venture. They've created some pretty good airlines airliners over the years, but this is the European government competing with the U.S. company, and which does not have any help from the or not any direct help from the government, but they've created an airplane that's not working, haven't they?
Well, I mean, ultimately, like everything, it's a product. And, other airlines worldwide are voting, with their money. And they really like Boeing's long-range
smaller
747-8.
Jets. Yeah. Well, and not only the 747, but Boeing is being very successful selling some of the smaller long-range planes.
Oh, yes.
Like the 777 and the 787.
Oh, right.
And as opposed to the 380, which is a huge airplane.
And what
Airbus failed to do was to see the direction of the marketplace.
Ultimately, it's marketplace decisions. And Airbus said, you know, market for Titanic-sized aircraft. And, but the airlines themselves, I mean, they're the ones who do that. They say no, you know, we do need big ones, but we need more, we need big ones that are more fuel efficient, and we need shorter range and smaller ones
right.
as well to meet our passenger needs. So Boeing is doing very well right now.
Well, and Airbus now has got so much invested in this A380
right.
that they almost can't turn around. They can't, you know, their funds are sucking for that project, are sucking up their funds that they could be using to develop other products. And so that's the reason.
That's right.
We're mentioning this, folks, is there are only two real airliner companies in the world, Boeing
right.
and this company,
and Airbus,
and Airbus. And so it's going to have an impact. All of this is going to have an impact on those of us who travel by air. Hey, thank you, Jim, for being here. Good job today, as always.
Thank you, Jim, and everyone.
We'll see you next time. Jim Ostroff, ladies and gentlemen, associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.